Thank you very much, Stephen, for the introduction and the invitation to be here. Last year's speech was about interesting times, and I'm happy to say that this year was a little less interesting than last year. Not quite boring enough yet, but in the right direction. I'm not going to give you a forecasting talk tonight. What I want to talk about is recent developments in financial regulation. The crisis that engulfed all of us last year, and which brought a number of international important banks to the brink, has been followed by a good deal of soul-searching in the regulatory community around the world. In a number of countries, not in Australia, but a number of other countries, regulatory structures and practices have been thought to have been inadequate. So work is proceeding at a furious pace, I might add, to try to establish better arrangements so that we can prevent the next crisis, or more realistically, make it less costly. All the while seeking to avoid doing anything that makes it harder to get out of this crisis. So I want to offer a little bit of information about that today and some observations about some of the issues here. I'm not going to talk about the cause of the crisis per se. We've all done that at great length in the past. And the material here is in an international setting, not an Australian one. So just to be clear, if I mean to say something about Australia, I will make that explicit, okay? What I'd like to do first is to ask what lessons have governments and regulators around the world drawn from the crisis? There are a number, but the ones that I want to talk about we can organise under five headings. The first one is capital. There was not enough. In the case of global banks' trading books, a lot of risk had accumulated. It wasn't very well managed. Capital held against complex structured products in particular was seriously inadequate. A good deal of risk which was supposed to be off balance sheet ended up coming back on pretty quickly when things turned bad. Some instruments which were considered to be capital actually could not bear losses, at least while the bank concerned remained running, so they weren't really capital. So that's the first lesson, not enough capital. Second, liquidity. Not enough attention had been paid to the risk that in times of market pressure, funding liquidity could become much more difficult. Moreover, comfortable assumptions about the liquidity, the market liquidity of various instruments proved to be unfounded when things went wrong. Third conclusion is about the shadow banking system, so-called. There were systematically important things going on beyond the regulatory perimeter. That included the activities of investment banks, hedge funds, finance companies, money market mutual funds, institutions that had various ties to banks, SIVs, SPVs, conduits, etc. These entities typically were less closely supervised, if at all, but in some cases their risk-taking behaviour and their subsequent travails had systemically important effects on the core of the system. Fourthly, cross-border arrangements were not adequate. Globally active banks and other entities operated apparently seamlessly across national borders. But the legal structures to allow that to happen actually were quite complex. And legal, supervisory and crisis management arrangements remained nationally based. So when it came time to manage the deleveraging or the winding up of some institutions, the degree of complexity of that task was greatly increased by the cross-border nature of the issues. And then finally, inevitably, pro-cyclicality. This episode demonstrated again that the financial system imparts its own dynamic that reinforces the natural cyclical tendency in an economy. In good times, lenders and investors tend to be confident. They behave with less caution. Standards decline. Banks come under pressure either to use so-called surplus capital or to return it to shareholders. Backward-looking risk metrics present risk as low just when it's approaching a peak, and they present it as very high after everybody has already become very risk-averse. So that all serves to fuel the boom and bust. Many commentators have argued as well that accounting standards contributed to pro-cyclicality. Fair value accounting and buoyant markets make for strong valuations that can boost recorded profits. But problems emerge when banks have to mark to market securities whose markets have effectively ceased to function. The incurred loss basis for provisions, where an event has to occur before a bank can take a provision on an exposure, promotes transparency in one sense, but it arguably inhibits the build-up of buffers in good times that can cushion against future losses, and it prompts more provisioning once the downturn has begun, further harming profitability and confidence. Other incentives have also been seen as adding to cyclical behaviour. Remuneration packages for some financial institutions, executives and employees appear to have been structured in a way that may have encouraged traders and managers to take excessive risks in areas that looked profitable in the short term, but in the medium term led to large losses. And as well as all those, people have pointed to a range of other things that had some contribution. Earlier regulatory changes which pushed American banks into subprime lending, credit ratings and the role of credit rating agencies, the complexity of instruments, weaknesses in market infrastructure, not to mention the long period of low global interest rates, the search for yield, global imbalances and all those things. I don't mean to underplay any of those, but the five that I mentioned are the ones that I want to focus on tonight because they are where the main focus of regulatory response is planned. So there were five conclusions about capital, liquidity, pro-cyclicality, cross-border, and so on. What then is being done about this? Well, there's a lot of work underway to respond to this. The various standard setters, Basel Committee, the IASB, FASB, various groups, the Financial Stability Board, which brings all those groups together, the G20 process, all these bodies have work streams underway to respond to these conclusions. And I think you can organise those responses under the same five headings. So let me talk about what those responses are likely to be. First among them is capital regulation. Now here, before I go on with that, I think it's worth pointing out that it's something of a stretch to suggest, as some commentators seem to do, that the so-called Basel II capital framework was to blame for the crisis. In fact, the build-up to the crisis happened under the old Basel capital standards, Basel I. Most global banks didn't implement Basel II until the crisis was already underway. US banks are still not using it, even now. Basel II isn't perfect, but it does address some of the shortcomings that were identified by the crisis. It does allow greater differentiation between the different types of risk. It introduces capital charges for some off-balance sheet exposures. It neutralises, at least to some extent, incentives between holding assets on or off-balance sheet or securitising them. So had Basel II been in place, I don't think we could claim that would have prevented the crisis, but I think it might have helped matters. Nonetheless, it can be improved in the light of what we've learned. The Basel Committee on Bank Supervision is in the process of implementing numerous changes which essentially will require more capital and higher quality capital from banks. It's already finalised changes to risk weights on some securitisation exposures. It's issued new guidance on compensation, governance, risk management and risk concentration. It's changed rules around disclosure and valuation, which will come into the effect at the end of next year. The committee is currently rethinking the amount of high-quality capital banks should hold, specifying what instruments can be included as high-quality capital, and it's also developing a non-risk-weighted leverage ratio that I'm going to come back to in a minute. The committee's working to finalise all of that by the end of this year. In fact, there are meetings on in Basel at the moment on this. And there's to be a detailed quantitative impact study on all this during 2010. So the first response is capital change, capital regulation. On liquidity, the Basel Committee likewise is planning on introducing a new global standard for funding liquidity soon. That will require, most likely, financial institutions to focus on adequate liquidity over a longer period and to have resilience to more demanding stress scenarios. And APRA, as you know, has recently released for consultation some proposals along these lines for Australian banks. Thirdly, the regulatory perimeter, which is the fancy new way of describing the size of the regulatory net, it's being extended. Of course, some of the less strongly supervised institutions don't exist anymore. US investment banks failed, were absorbed by regulated banks, or indeed became one themselves. So that problem perhaps is less than it was. But other institutions whose activities are thought as perhaps likely to be of systemic significance, like, say, hedge funds, are also going to enjoy more regulation in the future. Fourthly, attempts are being made to improve the cross-border cooperation and flow of information between supervisors through the creation of so-called supervisory colleges for large institutions, so that a bank which is active in many countries, the supervisory college would include many of the supervisors from the nations where it is active. This is all designed to improve sharing of information. And there's also work going on at the Financial Stability Board on protocols for cross-border crisis management. And then fifthly, regarding pro-cyclicality, proposals are being developed for the use of capital regulations that would require banks to have, in a sense, varying capital ratios over the cycle, building up capital in good times that can be run down in bad times. This involves introducing target capital ratios above the minimum, above the redesigned Basel minimum. The Basel Committee is also working on how to implement more forward-looking loan loss provisioning based on expected losses rather than on the incurred loss arrangement. The accounting standards setters are doing their work, which is a very long and drawn-out, difficult process, working to make things simpler, to get convergence between the US and the rest of the world, and so on and so forth. Well, all of that is very important work. It forms part of a comprehensive set of responses to the conclusions that have been drawn from the crisis experience. And implementing it represents a very demanding schedule for global regulators. What I'd like to do now is offer a few observations about some of these issues and about what we might realistically expect to achieve. These comments are not criticisms, but they're rather nuances that I think are worth noting and keeping in mind. The first is that the right balance needs to be struck between more regulation and stronger enforcement of existing regulation. No doubt regulation can be improved after an event like this. But the fact remains that some jurisdictions ended up with terrible problems and others did not, even though we were all pretty much using the same general internationally accepted regulatory framework. So the question why that difference in outcomes, it seems to me, remains one of interest. Second, on the assumption that most of these regulatory changes go ahead, one effect presumably will be to make the process of financial intermediation more costly. The intention, after all, is that lenders will operate with more capital against the risks that they are taking. But capital isn't free. Shareholders have to be induced to supply it, so it will have to be paid for. High-quality liquid assets also carry some relatively lower yields, so at the margin, some small effect in costs will come from those arrangements too. Now, you can argue that if these regulatory changes make banks safer, then bank shareholders have got a safer investment and so could expect to receive a lower return at the margin than they used to get. But customers of financial institutions, that is, depositors and borrowers, will also pay via higher spreads between what lenders pay for funds and what they charge for loans. That is to say, they will pay more ex ante to use a safer financial system, as opposed to taxpayers having to pay large costs ex post to fix up a more risky system that gets into trouble. Now, of course, protecting the interests of taxpayers is very important, and there's no doubt that certain types of behaviour need to be at least better capitalised, if not severely curtailed or even stopped altogether. And it's appropriate that pricing play a role in that. We should try to ensure, however, that the costs that we bear is no more than necessary. The most egregious behaviour was mainly that of 30 or 40 large internationally active banks, none of them Australian. They've imposed very large costs on their own financial system, their own governments, and the global economy. But there are thousands of other banks in the world whose risk appetite didn't get out of control, that have remained solvent, and that didn't need an injection of public capital to survive. So it will be sensible to ensure, as far as we can, that the proposed measures act effectively to constrain the worst excesses of the former group, the group that were the problem, without unnecessarily shackling all the other banks. On the leverage ratio, I'm personally not actually persuaded of the intellectual basis of this. It seems to me that it goes against the whole thrust of what Basel's been on about for the past 20 years, that is, allocating capital against economic risk. After all, the Basel weight's already really a leverage ratio, it's just a fancy one. And I've not seen persuasive evidence that countries that had or have had a leverage ratio in place have systematically outperformed those that did not. Nonetheless, it's already been agreed, and it had been agreed before Australian and other countries' officials joined the Basel Committee, that such a device would be introduced as a backstop against excessive leverage in instances where the Basel rules for some reason couldn't constrain that. Provided it's suitably calibrated, it probably won't do much harm. But that is a very important provision. Were it to be calibrated in a way which unnecessarily constrains the common or garden variety commercial bank around the world, it might end up being unduly costly. So the calibration's important. And in this regard, it's critical that adequate time be allowed for the completion of the technical work in assessing the quantitative impact of this measure, and for that matter, all the other measures that are under consideration. And that will take at least another year. As far as the proposed countercyclical capital buffers are concerned, well, that's intuitively very appealing. It's based on the notion that it's precisely at that time when capital seems abundant and inexpensive, profits are high and the economy's booming, that's the moment when true risk is actually approaching its peak. So requiring more capital to be put aside then, which you can then run down when things weaken, sounds very desirable, very sensible. But we shouldn't think that that will be easy to achieve. These proposals appear to involve balancing a degree of mechanical linkage of capital rules to particular variables, like credit growth, for example, with an appropriate amount of short-term flexibility. Well, those of you who are familiar with all the old debates about rules versus discretion in monetary policy will maybe see, as I do, a certain parallel here. Based on experience in monetary policy, I personally am sceptical of the durability of hard rules, but also very familiar with how hard it really is to deliver genuinely counter-cyclical policy in a discretionary way. And I don't think there's any reason to think that it will be any easier when using prudential tools for macro-prudential purposes. That's not to say that a framework to do that can't be devised. I'm sure it can be. But it might take a while. In the case of monetary policy, it took at least a couple of decades to get all of that sorted and get to the frameworks that most of us have today. If one is inclined to place a good deal of importance on quality supervisory judgment, and I think you have to, we may achieve as much by adjustments to accounting arrangements for provisions as by a complex set of variable capital ratios. What's really needed in provisions is the ability for a bank to set aside the provision when it or its supervisor thinks it should, rather than waiting for some event to trigger that adjustment, and that's an important area of work for regulators. I think we should also be realistic that while using balance sheet regulation as a macro-prudential tool may have attractions, it's no panacea. Of course, there may be occasions when the setting of monetary policy is about right for most of the economy, but you want to dampen borrowing behaviour in some particular area. In those cases, some kind of temporary regulatory measure may well be useful. But those of you who are old enough to have any recollection of the Australian public policy debates of the 60s and 70s, as you will know, if the fundamental problem is actually that monetary conditions are too easy, that is, interest rates are too low, balance sheet regulation won't constrain credit growth. Over time, private markets find a way of doing that business that evades the regulation. And then the authorities face the question of whether they want to expand the regulatory net to include those institutions. A possible outcome is that the harder we regulate one set of institutions as a result of the past crisis, the more likely it becomes that the next crisis takes place in the hitherto unregulated sector, possibly even among institutions which don't exist yet. If the conditions are such that people want to take risk and gear up, then they will find a way of doing it. Now, of course, that's acceptable, provided that the relevant parties can be allowed to fail without bringing down the core part of the financial system. Caveat emptor can apply outside the regulated net if there are a few spillovers. But the thing is that if risk-taking goes on long enough, then there's at least some chance that sufficient leverage will have accumulated somewhere to make the ensuing deleveraging generally disruptive. And then policymakers, once again, are put in a very difficult position. And that brings me to the most difficult of all the issues that arises from all of this, namely that of the too big to fail institution. Here the term big might mean just a large balance sheet. It might mean interconnectedness. It might mean complexity. It might mean all of those things. probably does mean all those things. In some countries, the debate on this is now very active, and there are a number of responses being talked about. One of them is a tax on size, more or less. That's what it is. That is much higher capital requirements on institutions defined to be systemic, quote unquote, so that you either greatly lower the probability that a large firm fails, or you give large firms an incentive not to be large anymore, and therefore lower the damage if they should subsequently fail. Another approach would be much more intensive and intrusive supervision of systemic entities. Either of those measures could be complemented by the requirement that a firm compile a so-called living will. That is, it writes its own break-up and wind-down plan while it's still alive, in the process hopefully highlighting which bits of complexity ought to be removed while it's still alive. Of course, before regulators get to implement any of those potential responses, they would have to grapple with the practical difficulty of setting the threshold as to which institutions should be counted as being systemic. I think we can expect furious lobbying from the banking industry on that particular question. Nor is this issue just domestic in nature. It actually goes to the heart of what it means to have an international globalised financial system. In the absence of clearly articulated rules about burden sharing, a potential failure of one of these institutions is further complicated because the frameworks for global governance and crisis resolution have not kept up with the process of globalisation itself. And it's very hard for those processes to keep up. If you think about Europe, here is a region that's had six decades of continual effort to build collective structures and cooperation. But even there, the resolution of problems at entities like Fortis has, by all accounts, been very, very difficult. Well, one response to that problem, the too big to fail across borders, would be to unwind the globalisation of the financial institutions and go back to having banks, just local banks, do local business. But that's extremely costly, and in general, I think most of us would agree that, on the whole, capital flows have been a great boost to higher living standards over the long run. So we don't really want to totally unwind globalisation. A less radical response would be subsidiarisation, that is, that the foreign bank operating on your shores does so as a subsidiary with local capital, local governance, so that the local authorities could intervene in that entity in the event of a shock in another country affecting the viability of the parent. That probably still entails some cost of efficiency, though maybe ones that countries would now be prepared to accept. Of course, to succeed in that approach, a country would have to have the capability and resources to ensure the viability of a local sub of a large global bank, even take control of it if necessary, at a time when there was tremendous damage to the relevant global brand happening. And so for many small countries, that might be a big ask. In the crisis itself, these too big to fail questions really just presented as an imperative for governments in a number of countries to prevent failures. A little more than a year ago, the G7 actually publicly committed there will be no more failures. And they had to. But as the crisis recedes and the global system is gradually nursed back to health, it is this issue that's going to leave the biggest lingering challenge. The Financial Stability Board will be directing particular attention to these questions over the coming years. They're not likely to be amenable to simple solutions or easy ones, I don't think. In the meantime, enormous moral hazard, maybe bigger than ever before, exists in the global financial system as a result of the actions, albeit necessary in the circumstances, that were taken in 2008. Well, time to finish. A year ago, I wished this audience a much less interesting 2009. That was partly fulfilled. It was less interesting than 2008, though still not boring enough, in my view. As 2009 draws to a close, things in the global financial system look much less worrying than they did a year ago. As the sense of immediate crisis passes, regulators can devote more energy to the job of designing and implementing changes to regulatory frameworks, and that work is better done outside an immediate crisis arrangement situation anyway. Realistically, the task is to reconfigure the framework so as to lower the probability and the cost of future crises while assisting in the recovery from this one. That is every bit as difficult a challenge as getting through the crisis itself. It will require very careful judgment to strike the right balance between costs and benefits of revised supervisory arrangements, and due regard to the possibility of unintended consequences. It will also take, I think, a great deal of determination on the part of regulators to enforce whatever the new arrangements are in future booms. And there will be such booms, because ultimately the cycle of greed and fear cannot be regulated away. To assume that unrealistic optimism will not again at some point overwhelm the more sober instincts of investors, bankers, commentators and others would be a triumph of hope over experience. But it can't be beyond us to achieve some worthwhile reforms in this area, and I think there are reasonable grounds to hope that 2010 is a year in which we can at least make some progress. So with that, I wish all of you a Merry Christmas, prosperous and stable and boring 2010. Thank you.
Good evening, Glenn. Lewis South from Macquarie Funds Group. A little bit off topic tonight, if I may. I'm sorry, I've been a few years now out of the RBA, Glenn, so you'll have to forgive me for this. The move by the majors in the last week has really brought into focus for a few people, I think, the fact that maybe that your board won't have to do quite as much with the cash rate to have the same impact on the economy. And I think that's a theme that you actually mentioned in a speech in a Q&A session back in October, that maybe in the short run the neutral rate is lower now than is the norm. We've certainly calculated ourselves that an average borrowing rate for a new borrower in the economy today is probably the equivalent now to a 5% cash rate 18 months ago. So I was wondering if you would maybe venture into giving your views on just how low the effective neutral rate, if you like, is for the cash rate may be at present, and whether, given you've moved 75 basis points now, a move in the view from the statement last week, whether or not the balance of risks in your mind may now be changing, given that your current forecasts don't actually suggest a need to go to neutral, or certainly not past neutral, over the coming 12 months.
Well, there's two questions in there. I think, where is neutral and how fast are we going there, which is, interestingly enough, a question I get asked just occasionally. I think all other things equal, if you allow for the fact that margins have widened, as you say, and assuming that remains the case into the future, that per se I think does mean that wherever you thought neutral was, that's a reason to think it might be lower. I can think of other things which you might argue would push it up over time, actually, like a faster growing economy. Generally, you would think of neutral as related to that as well. And seeing as how population growth is now the highest for 40 years, growth of capital stocks quite high, you could argue that potential growth in the economy is a bit higher. And I would think that might be tending to tell you that neutral could move up, other things equal. So you've got countervailing things here. We're not doctrinaire about where neutral is, and where, you know, we'll kind of know it when we see it, I guess. The the question of the forecasts, I think what you're alluding to is they don't say things are going seriously. Of course, they don't. That's quite right. The forecasts do, of course, embody the assumption that interest rates gradually increase over the forecast period, not necessarily to any particular target number, but there is some upward trend built in there, and that's, in a sense, the forecaster's assessment of the policy path that delivers the forecast. David?
David Uren from the Australian newspaper. Governor, your speech canvassed the sort of issues that might be tackled by APRA. Until now, if I remember correctly, you've basically said that the issue as to whether the Reserve Bank should itself lean into the wind of asset bubbles is a debate that needs to be had. I'm wondering whether you've sort of strengthened your position on which side of that debate you and the Reserve Bank stand. Is it something that should be incorporated into our way of thinking about monetary policy?
Well, I'm not sure I can advance, David, any further than the answers I've given on that question at length, which I suppose you could interpret as remaining constructively ambiguous for the time being. I suppose my position is I'm not anxious to go chasing asset prices, but equally I would never say never. So that is a somewhat ambiguous position, but I think that's the only reasonable position to adopt on that question. Bill.
Governor, sort of follow-up to Lewis's question, a slightly more different way of looking at it. We saw last week where the banks raised their rates by more than the Reserve Bank move. Do you see that, given that business credit is actually contracting, do you almost see that as taking some pressure off your need to continue to raise rates? And related to that question, given that the banks indicated this sharp rise in their funding costs emanating from offshore, do you think that there may be a significant sting in the tail for Australia from the GFC?
Well, I'm interested to see Westpac asking this question. Policy will take into account these changes in margins, absolutely, of course, as we've always said we would. As to the extent of the rise in overall funding costs, be it from offshore or equally from intense competition in the deposit market, that is obviously a factor that banks are taking into account. We've actually published some analysis of how to think about this, and we'll probably update that some point next year to at least give people a framework within which to debate these questions, because I think often the various participants in this debate speak a different language to each other, and it's helpful to have a framework. What that framework showed, for what it's worth, up to a few months ago, was that overall margins had declined initially in the first half of the crisis and then recovered all that ground since. It will be interesting to see what that shows in another few months' time.
Michael Knox, RBS Morgans. Governor, if I interpret your line of country precisely, you're worried that regulatory institutions might overreact to the current circumstance. And this was a great concern this afternoon at the forecasting conference. In one of the presentations, it was suggested that APRA was overreacting by prospectively generating a higher need for liquidity than was otherwise the case. This would damage credit creation and sever the relationship or the historical relationship between where interest rates were and credit was, and therefore mean that a movement in interest rates would have more damaging effect than would otherwise be the case. In your interest in to make sure that regulators don't overreact, when might be your next meeting with APRA?
Well, we're in dialogue with APRA over these issues all the time, and actually I don't think anything I've said here tonight would cause John Laker any heartburn at all. The liquidity proposals, as I understand them, are being consulted on. They're not final at this point, and I'm sure they'll be able to come up with a set of arrangements which meets the test of doing what's needed, which is to get a bit more focus on liquidity management. I think everybody accepts that globally that was underdone in the lead-up to the crisis, but which will work in Australia's situation. I'd be pretty sure that they'll be able to come up with something that will work. And we're meeting with them, we're in dialogue with them continually about all manner of things, that one included, but a whole lot of other things.
Governor David Plank from Deutsche Bank, actually related to the previous question, what's your view about the trade-off in terms of the liquidity rules between APRA or the liquidity rules we end up with between global consistency and taking note of Australia's different circumstances, in particular, I suppose, the absence or the relative lack of high-quality AAA assets?
Sure. Well, we've got to find a balance there. You can't just ignore global standards completely. What you can do is seek to have those standards recognise a certain degree of national differences. And historically, the Basel standards in a range of areas have done that. That's, you know, partly why it took 20 years to get Basel II in place. So you can't ignore them, but you've got to be able to tailor the specific measures in a way which will work. Everybody knows that, literally speaking, the proposals that come out of Basel would have Australian banks holding much more than all the government debt that exists in this country. Obviously, that's not going to be possible. So some other way of handling this needs to be found, but I think it can be.
G'day, Glenn. Good to see you once again. Sam Silva from Sydney, an infrastructure asset manager in the New South Wales public sector. Glenn, you mentioned a couple of times since the Melbourne conference last month the fact that things are less worrying, and when we come out of the hole, we will end up with a lesser economic capacity. Ideally, Glenn, to counteract the impact of GFC on on Australian economy, when we devise monetary policy and the fiscal sort of direction, is the ideal scenario to have those two policies travelling in the same direction in hand in glove fashion? If so, how do you go about doing that to achieve the synergistic sort of policy objectives outlined in those scenarios?
I think the question is it the right thing for fiscal and monetary policy to go in the same direction? Well, the answer is obviously yes. And I think the way to think about this is that fiscal measures, as designed, are already tailing off compared to their maximum impact on either the level or the growth rate of GDP. Now, there may be some slippage in some of the fiscal measures that pushes some of the impact into the latter part of 2009 when it was supposed to be a bit earlier, but that's probably not that big a problem, provided that the rest of the scheduled events take place. And monetary policy, as David, I think, said today, is still expansionary, just not quite so expansionary as it was. So I think, actually, that the two arms are, roughly speaking, they're working in parallel, which is obviously what they need to do. Rory's turn.
Rory Robertson, Macquarie. Governor, one of the important parts of the job of an economic forecast is explaining ex post how we were always right and not much that we said was wrong. Back in early in the year when the bank was cutting
rates,
good luck
on that one.
Would you have rated a high chance you might be hiking by the end of the year?
I mean, did I predict what...
Yeah,
I think, well, I think at the beginning of the year, I would not have expected to have the economy as looking as good as it does. I mean, you know, I said we were in recession in April, so I felt that things were going to turn out rather worse than they have. But who's complaining? Not me.
Mr. Stevens, John Rolfe from the Daily Telegraph. In your opinion, was the largest move amongst the major banks in response to to the Reserve Bank's recent rate rise, was the largest move, was that reasonable? Was it justifiable?
Well, I'm not here to comment, John, on the reasonableness or otherwise of decisions that private firms take. I'm not here to defend them. They're big boys and girls. They can give their own account of it. I take note of what's happened, but I haven't got any further comment than that. Next.
Good evening, Governor. My name's Amelia Christopher and I'm from National Australia Bank. Prior to the global financial crisis, the Australian economy experienced some capacity constraints, particularly in regard to labour markets. Given that the unemployment rate has not reached some of the forecast peaks or may not reach those levels in the coming months, what advice do you have to the private sector and to the government in regards to concerns around capacity constraints returning, which would lead to cost push inflation over the coming months?
Well, I'm not going to indulge in giving gratuitous advice to businesses or governments here tonight. But the question you raise is an important one. There were clearly capacity issues right up really until the crisis worsened abruptly in September last year. And even as we sit here, the mining sector in some areas is pretty much back to capacity. They've got a lot of investment coming on, though, which will grow that capacity. And labour market, well, there's some spare capacity there now, and there's a lot of population growth coming, so that will help on the capacity front in certain respects, though, of course, those people create demand as well as supply. So it's certainly an issue. My only observation, I suppose, is to say that in a sense, for us to be returning, if we are, to the economics of managing full employment, there's a lot of other countries in the world who would like to have that problem. One more.
Governor Michael Stutchbury from The Australian. I just want to refer to an issue that was raised at the conference today and has also been raised by one of the Reserve Bank board members. It's the issue of whether the emergency monetary policy settings that still apply in the United States and the quantitative easing is producing an excess of liquidity, which is ending up sloshing into the Asian region and fueling asset price bubbles in our own Asian region. I wonder to what extent that you consider that to be a concern for you as a central bank governor in Australia.
Well, it's more of a concern for my counterparts in Asia, I think, where their own interest rates remain very low and economies are recovering pretty smartly in a number of instances, most cases. And some of them do have this sense that the ultra-low rates, not just in the US, but Japan and Germany, you know, the G3 is basically on rock bottom, and that you get carry trade activity and so on. In our case, we certainly get some capital flows, but the exchange rate, of course, does what it's supposed to do in that environment, which is it rises, and given the mineral sector build-up we're seeing, that's okay by and large. That's not a comment about today's exchange rate, it's just a general observation about the the broader moves we've seen. In Asia, it's harder for them because they're less comfortable with letting exchange rates take the pressure. And so they've got then the search for what other measures they might take to calm down potential problems in asset markets. So you've seen several of them do things like maximum LVRs on housing loans and this kind of thing just in the past month. That's a recognition and a response to the kind of capital flow issue that you're talking about. My own sense is that I don't know when the Fed's going to start lifting rates, but the assumption we've been working on is it's quite some time off yet. So I think these issues are going to be around with us for at least the next year or so. And it's going to be, you know, a difficult problem for our colleagues in Asia to deal with. I think it doesn't worry me from an Australian economy perspective directly. It's more of a concern of how they manage to cope with it up in the region, and then, you know, whether that damages their prospects and therefore affects us down the track. So it's an issue, you know, if you're not prepared to let the exchange rate adjust, then you've got to find these other devices to handle the flows. And that's the track they're on at the moment. Rob.
Governor, Rob Henderson from the bank with the lowest variable mortgage rates. And actually, my question's about that, because I think house prices are really interesting at the moment, and I must admit in our forecast at National Australia Bank we've been juggling with the various factors that influence house prices. And I guess when I think about house prices, I think about the last two quarters that have seen quite a sharp resurgence in house prices in Australia, and I guess the partial data is difficult to read, but certainly the evidence we're getting from the weekly auction clearance rates and so on are suggesting the housing market's pretty solid. And it looks like we're getting towards the peak of the unemployment rate. I think Stephen said earlier that the average economist on the committee of the ABE is now forecasting a peak of 6.2, which is very low, and that's obviously a factor which influences house prices. So, look, to get to my question, some time back in Malaysia, I think, you mentioned that asset price bubbles were an issue that central bankers had to think about in terms of the outlook, and at that stage we're in the middle of the crisis. Now we're moving out of the crisis. I'm wondering where the Reserve Bank's thinking is going in terms of house prices and how much influence that might have on policy decisions in the future.
Well, a number of my colleagues, Tony Richards, who's sitting here, have given talks about house prices and done far better than I will standing here thinking off the top of my head. But, you know, is it a bubble? I'm not sure that's obvious what's happening. I think there are some fundamental demand and supply issues. So it doesn't... One should not immediately conclude that that's a bubble. You know, there's a threshold test you have to pass before you can reach that conclusion. Certainly, though, household wealth, both through dwelling prices and equity prices, has staged quite a comeback after some very big falls a year back. That matters for economic outcomes. I think the buoyancy in the property market for housing generally is one of the things that's helping support confidence, and that's part of the dynamic we're seeing. So that's all factored in. Which isn't the same thing as saying that house prices per se are the thing we're going after. That's not the case at this point in time. Mr. Roth wants another go. Okay.
You only get one chance a year, so I may as well have a second crack. Governor, many banks, including the bank that made the largest of the rate rises recently, have relied upon Reserve Bank data in justifying that decision. You mentioned that that was going to be updated. Is it in some ways misleading to rely upon that data because it's for a different time and that in fact mortgage margins are on the increase?
Well, I'm not sure what data they claimed to be relying on, John. But what we published was simply by way of public service. I think here's a framework in which to think about funding costs. Here's a set of general assumptions, and we don't have the highly disaggregated numbers for any individual bank. What we've got are broad system type numbers. And so any individual bank would presumably say that their own figures are very slightly different in some way. Fair enough. But the task that we set ourselves was simply to write down a framework, and you can put your own numbers in, your own set of assumptions, and draw conclusions. I think the problem in this whole debate is often that people talk different languages. A lot of bankers talk spreads, and they talk about, you know, the cost of funds has trebled, the spread has trebled, but the absolute total number of points they're paying in total hasn't trebled. It's increased by a lesser number. So it depends what measure you're using. And the point of us publishing something and at some point updating it is simply to give people a framework within at least which they can have a sensible conversation instead of talking past each other. That's really as good as I can do, I think, on that question tonight. Okay, thanks.